And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Jim Mars wants to know what the government knows about unidentified flying object phenomenon that has been reported, photographed, videotaped in skies around the world for decades. Alleged top-secret American government documents have been leaked which describe extraterrestrial biological entities and their advanced aerial craft and technologies. Now, in one of Jim's many books, Alien Agenda, Investigating the Extraterrestrial Presence Among Us, Jim's efforts to understand the ET mystery brings him now to the second annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, actually Henderson, Nevada, along with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, how you doing out there?
Hi, George. I wish you were here.
Well, it sounds like you are here. Great. You sound wonderful.
Yeah. Well, this is actually kind of fun. We've got L.A. and Las Vegas joined together on Coast tonight for what I think is going to be a really special exploration through time, going all the way from 1897 right up to the current day, and increasing evidence, George, in a lot of directions, what we've all talked about for so long. Our government has a tremendous amount of knowledge about something that is off-planet, let's put it that way, and we're all trying to find out what and why. And, you know, with Jim, this 1897 year, George, that's going back 107 years.
That's a long time.
And it's 50 years before 1947. Think how controversial 47 has been. So if we say 1897, dear Jim Mars, what in the world made you feel that there was something there that you would take seriously enough to put your very skillful investigative energy and try to find out if there really was a crash of something in Aurora, Texas, 107 years ago?
Well, I think the thing that really intrigues me about this story is that for a long time, in looking at the UFO phenomena, there's all kinds of explanations. You know, it used to be swamp gas and hallucinations, but of course, with the camcorder, we now know that there are things flying around up there. It's not just hallucinations.
But that's now. What about 1897?
Well, that's the whole question. I've often thought, wouldn't it be great if there was a really documented UFO crash case before there were satellites or airplanes or commercial planes or government test craft? And there is, and it was recorded in the Texas newspapers in the spring of 1897. And what I'm bringing to the Crash Retrieval Conference this time is a little added piece of information that's really going to put it into the smoking gun category.
Can you tell us right now?
Sure. This goes back. I began researching the Aurora spaceship crash back in 1973 when I was a reporter in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And it kind of went both ways. Half the people there said, oh, it was just a hoax. The other half said, no, it really happened. And in fact, in 1973, there were still three people alive in that area that had been alive in 1897. One of them said it was a hoax, but by her own story, had no direct knowledge. Another one said, no, it really happened, but my parents wouldn't let me go to the crash site, but they came back and told me about all this metal. And the third one, Charlie Stevens, told me that he was about 14 years old, and that he actually saw the thing go over and heard the crash, saw the smoke, wanted to run into town to see what had happened. But, and this is such a typical thing for rural Texas at that time, his father said, no, son, we have to finish the chores. Well, so, obviously, it seems like that to me that something happened, but then there's a whole long thing that's too detailed about missing metal from the short little grave where they buried the pilot, the missing headstone, arguments over exhuming the body.
Well, this is where I'd like you to at least go into some detail, because I've seen a photograph of this unusual tombstone about this little man that was buried in Aurora, Texas. And I have talked with Tom Adams and others who have been there. And what I'm asking you is, since it's been so controversial, is there anything, any person, any piece of evidence beyond that marker in that graveyard that would suggest that people had in their arms, so to speak, a body that was not human and actually buried it?
I was going to say, yes. Is that a little man, Jim, or a little creature?
Well, they called him the pilot, and the whole thing, George, is that it was reported in the Dallas Morning News, which is still in publication today, and in the Fort Worth Register, for which was a forerunner of my old newspaper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And in both cases, on the front page in a news story, they said enough of the remains of the pilot has been found to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. Okay, now, for all these years, they cannot argue that these stories were in the newspapers at that time. But what the argument has been from the debunkers is that it was simply a hoax story, just planted in the newspaper to try to draw attention to the little town because it was dying on the vine because the railroad bypassed it. And that's, of course, entirely possible. Mm-hmm. And I certainly kept that in mind over all the years. But several months ago, I managed to get hold of a copy from the microfilm of the original April the 19th, 1897 edition of the Dallas Morning News. There are 16 stories on that front page. That was the times of no photographs and very narrow news columns and very tiny print. 16 stories, and they came from correspondents ranging from southern Oklahoma to as far south as Austin, Texas. And every single one of these stories on the front page of the Dallas Morning News in 1897 was about the silver cigar-shaped object flying through the skies of North Texas. So something was in the air 6 years before the Wright brothers ever flew and 6 years before the first recorded powered dirigible flight in the United States.
And is that marker still in that cemetery?
No, the marker was stolen, has not been seen since 1973. But there is a state historical marker at the cemetery that was put up in 1976 that down towards the bottom says, legend has it that a spaceship crashed here and the pilot who was killed in the crash was buried here in the Aurora Cemetery.
And wasn't there a rumor that the government, our government, somebody from our government actually went in there to make sure that that marker disappeared?
Well, my wife teaches high school in the area and had the grandson of the town marshal in her class, and he told her that his grandfather knew who took the marker but could not do anything about it.
So in other words,
a law enforcement officer knew who committed this crime, but he can't do anything about it. That certainly tells me that there was some sort of official involvement there.
Now, have the bones been exhumed? Are they gone? Where do you think they are?
Well, I don't really know. The grave has not been exhumed, but that was something that came up back in 73. George, I'll tell you that story because I was personally involved in that. Bill Casey at that time was the aviation writer for the now-defunct Dallas Times-Herald. We were all writing about this in the spring of 1973. And he called me up one time and said, meet me at the Aurora Cemetery. And when I met him, he had a metal detector. And he went over the short little grave there. The headstone was still there at this time. And we found three, I don't know what you'd call them, pockets of metal, three registers of metal, in this little short grave. One up near the headstone and two towards the center of the grave. So we both went back and wrote news stories and simply raised the possibility of why don't we just simply exhume this grave. And then we'll know for sure, you know, one way or another. At that, an attorney cropped up for the Cemetery Association and threatened an injunction against anyone who would come dig in the cemetery. And in fact, they posted a police guard on the cemetery for about 2 weeks because of the number of people that were driving up from Dallas-Fort Worth and trying to drive around and look for everything. The very night that they pulled the police guard, the little headstone went missing and has never been seen since. About a month or so after that, Bill Case called me up and said, meet me at the Aurora Cemetery. I went up there and met him. He got out his metal detector. He ran it over this grave, which on first glance appeared to be, you know, undisturbed. And lo and behold, there was no readings. There was no metal.
Suggesting something had been taken out of what was underneath that gravestone.
Well, there definitely was. Yeah. Because I said, what happened? He said, come here. And we got on our hands and knees. And the grave had not been exhumed, but there was a little hole up near the where the tombstone had been, and then there were two little holes in the center of the grave. And it was obvious somebody had come in there with some very sophisticated equipment, used something akin to a core sampler, gone down into the grave and extracted the metal out of that grave.
Oh, my.
Now, to add to that story, some years ago, I met a woman who had grown up around that cemetery, and she told me that she was aware that federal agents had been poking around in that cemetery. Well, of course, with my experience in 1973, I said, oh, yes, I know what you're talking about. That was in 1973. And she said, no, this was when I was a little girl in the 1950s. So we've got government involvement in the 50s and in the 60s and in the 70s. And I met one old fellow up there in my presentation. I'm going to show a strange medallion that he thinks might be connected to this crash. And he said he was there in the late 80s with a metal detector, and he ran into federal agents who had metal detectors. And he said, I still remember his quote, he said, their metal detectors made my metal detector look like a toy.
And in addition to that medallion, I've seen a drawing of it, which will be very interesting to see in your presentation. Was there a drawing or drawings that somebody made back around 1897, allegedly, of this pilot? I think Tom Adams said that there had been a drawing or drawings, and this comes to the question, did anybody anywhere in any newspaper write any details about what the pilot looked like?
If they did, I'm unaware of it, Linda. I even checked some of the area newspapers up there to make sure that there were other accounts, and there were. I found in the Wise County Messenger several brief mentions of the airship and of the crash, but to my knowledge, I don't recall seeing anything of a drawing or anything of what the remains of this pilot looked like.
Except that it was very small, because I think that Tom right. Adams said that the locals even referred to it
how
as
small?
Being child-sized.
Right, okay, right, and I can tell you that the grave was definitely was no more than 4 foot in length. It was a very small grave, like a small child or a very, very small man.
Jim and Linda,
where is that metal?
That's what I was going to say, Linda. We've got a couple minutes left here before the break, and you want to bring Bob Wood in next. Tell me about the metal.
Well, this is really amazing, but I have talked to so many people up in that area who said, oh, you know, I used to have a piece of that metal when I was a kid. In fact, they all told me about an old man who would go up to the Wise County Fair every year and had a little cigar box full of little pieces of metal, and he would sell it, you know, to the kids and said this is metal from the spaceship. Everybody knows about it. Everybody said they had it at one time, but nobody can come up with it now.
Because the government probably got it, which comes, Jim, to your new work, 9/11. We're going from 1897 to 9/11. And the question of our government manipulating and orchestrating some of our history and events and suppressing UFOs, can you give us a quick update on what's happening with 9/11, your new book?
Yeah, I will be in, I'm leaving the crash conference and going to Los Angeles next week, and I'm speaking Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night in Los Angeles at the Living Temple, the Unitarian Church of Orange County, the Unitarian Universalist Church of South Orange County.
If you don't look me up, Jim, I'll be upset.
I know. And we are doing a new version, a new updated and reprinting of Inside Job, Unmasking the 9/11 Conspiracies. And by the way, I want to mention, George, our mutual friend Bill Burns said to be sure and mention that filamentbookclub.com. You will find the second edition, Inside Job, The War on Freedom, which gets into not only the 9/11 questions, but the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security, and all of the things that have all been stemmed, of course, from 9/11.
And I think your 9/11 book is so important because you have dug up some things that raise serious questions based on hard fact.
Absolutely. Can I give a toll-free number?
Yeah, go ahead, Jim, real quickly.
Okay, yeah, it's 1-800-247-6553. Again, that's 1-800-247-6553. This will give you the ammunition to talk to your friends, relatives, and try to explain to them that we... Everything we're doing today is based on our reactions to 9/11, and yet we really, truly don't know for certain what happened on 9/11, particularly in regards to the war game exercises that were taking place that morning and confused our defense system.
And when we come back, George, we're going to go beyond 1897 up into 1947 when the government began apparently to try to put a squeeze on what the public was receiving about a lot of subjects. And we'll be with Bob Wood, who has probably as much knowledge about the history of crash and retrievals in the United States.
Taking part right now at the Sunset Station Hotel and Casino. It's going to be going on through the weekend, by the way. Linda Moulton Howe will be there. And she's there broadcasting for us as we speak. Now, if a craft from an unknown world did crash in Aurora, Texas in 1897, how many disks have crashed here in the United States and also around the world? The first major effort to collect UFO crash retrieval reports and publish them was done by Leonard H. Stringfield. He was a great investigator. I knew him many years ago. Len died in 1994 at the age of 74 in his hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio. His work continues. In a moment, Dr. Bob Wood with Linda Moulton Howe. Bob Wood had a 43-year-long career as an aerospace engineer, first working for Douglas Aircraft that then merged with McDonnell Corporation in 1967, then to become McDonnell Douglas, later purchased by Boeing in the early 1990s. Over these four decades, Bob Wood worked as an aerodynamic heating, ballistic, missile defense, radar, and space station expert before his retirement in 1993. He's there now in Las Vegas with Linda Moulton Howe.
Hi, George and Bob, and we're now ready to go into one of the most interesting archives, I think, in the United States, which is the work of Len Stringfield. And you, Bob, we've talked about the fact that beyond Roswell, which appears that the government sort of drew a line in the sand and said, this is it. No, we're not talking about anything else. Roswell is it. And yet, Len Stringfield ended up with having information coming to him from the early 50s on that when he put together all of his status reports, which I have been reprinting at earthfiles.com with the permission of his family, I have been stunned myself by how much material is in all of these status reports that would suggest that whatever these craft are, that they've been coming down in a lot of places for a long time. Plus, Len told me himself at his house that he knew back in the early 50s that there was a standing order in our military to try to bring these things down out of the sky, and that we lost so many pilots that it was finally rescinded. In the work that you've been doing, trying to analyze all of the archives and all of his status report, what is the scope? How many? Where did it begin? And then let's talk about this interesting question. Were we trying to bring them down?
Well, the work of this brilliant man really started when he was in high school. They called him Webster because he'd memorized the whole dictionary. And he took that brilliance through his life, which actually began to be associated with UFOs in the war, when he saw a couple of Foo Fighters. And then in the 50s, he wound up offering to the Air Force the opportunity for him to give them reports of sightings from the public. And so if it was a real sighting confirmed by radar, they would send up fighter planes, and if it wasn't, why, in any case, they wouldn't tell him. But he may be the only guy who's ever been paid by the Air Force that paid his phone bills for investigating UFOs.
And that's where that famous title of his first book, 30 Blue, came from, right?
Yeah, his code letters were Foxtrot Kilo 3 Blue.
And George, this meant that Len Stringfield had kind of an official code. He would call up with an office in the early 50s in our government to report something having to do with an unidentified craft or light in the sky, and the military had a serious dialogue with Len Stringfield in terms of reporting.
I know. That's was way ahead of his time, wasn't he?
He really was. Many of us have come to the conclusion 10 years after he came to the conclusion. In fact, I'm jumping ahead, but I asked him personally before he died about 1990, you know, Len, how many crashes do you think have really happened? And I said, I'd like you to pick a number so that I can pick whether it's more than that or less than that, even money. So he hesitated for a minute. And he said, I'd say 10. But based on what I'm going to present at the conference, I think the number will be more like 30. They span from 1941 through 1990. And typically, 18 to 20 each one of those first four decades.
Now, we were developing surface-to-air missiles after World War II at White Sands Missile Range. There was Paperclip. We had surface-to-air developments that were based on the Wasserfeld. And I'm going to be presenting at this conference information coming from a political representative in the state of New Mexico that suggests that our government, just like Lynn had said, was actively trying to bring these disks down out of the skies, which may have increased the number. This may be part of the reason why they came down, and it may be part of the reason why it stopped after a point. Something might have occurred. Do you, in all of the information that you have acquired doing the Majestic 12 documents, have you ever had anyone come to you on or off the record and say that they had firsthand knowledge of an actual aggression by us against these craft?
And no, I haven't personally had that kind of report. However, there's a new book out by Ficino called The Braxton County Monster. It talks about the September 12th, I think, 1952, which is right in the time when Len was getting started, of some air-to-air combat where we shot down a craft, and it was called the Flatwoods County, Flatwoods Monster.
Could we have been that good at that time, Bob, to be able to knock them down with our technology, considering what they might have had?
Well, we lost some of our aircraft, but we, on the other hand, we had developed proximity fuses, Linda pointed out, in the early 40s, that testing was going on at White Sands. So it would be easy to imagine that if they wanted to shoot them down, they would try this brand new device called a proximity fuse.
And what we didn't know, and we were experimenting big time in New Mexico, was with microwaves and radar.
That's
and
right.
We know out of this new study that J. Andrew Kistner and Scott Ramsey did that there was a triangulation of strong radar set around to protect Los Alamos and Sandia Base. And what we don't know is if this is somebody else's technology from off planet, could our strong microwaves, not knowing really what we were doing exactly, have ended up interrupting whatever they use for their propulsion system?
I think it's quite possible that our radar or microwaves would have interfered with one of their control systems, and they probably figured out how to solve that problem, so it didn't happen again.
Could we have also woken up a sleeping giant? I mean, if we shot down several of their craft, I mean, they could have gone ballistic on us.
Retaliation, George, is a big question, and I'm going to be talking about it. And Bob, have you ever gotten into retaliation issues?
Well, we're getting quite a far afield from what Leonard Springfield would have said, because Leonard was a very careful researcher, and he never tried to say more than he really knew for sure. But you've asked me a question, you want me to speculate, so I will.
Because he wrote Situation Red, and he
right.
thought it was serious.
That's right.
Well, and what's so important is, I mean, here we are, if we were indeed during this era shooting down alien craft, I mean, eventually they would have gotten pretty angry, I would guess. Huh, Linda?
Well, I think that there is evidence for retaliation. Bob, how would you personally describe, from just looking at Len's material and knowing that there are a lot more crash retrievals than we would ever have thought, you think even speculating here, sitting here speculating, that there is this possibility that we were trying to bring them down exactly as Len said, and that might have increased the number that crashed?
Oh, I think there's a certainty that we were trying to bring them down. I think most of the crashes that we have records of from Lynn's records, 86 records in his books, I would say for the most part were caused by our aggressive attempts to bring them down. But the thing that I always have to keep in mind is that with the right perspective, you probably are dealing with a half a dozen or so different alien societies.
Right.
And if one comes and gets shot down, why, they go away for a while, another one comes along. They don't always communicate with each other. This is all speculation. If Len were answering this question, he would be wanting to deal only with the facts that he had reported to him, which are remarkably consistent across a wide variety of reports over a wide variety of decades.
And the mystery is, retaliation by a non-human intelligence would take what form? That becomes a very interesting answer.
Well, one of the cases that's really quite specific, let me give you an example.
Okay.
This comes from, actually from Don Ecker, was the first person who told Len years and years ago that he had this report. And this was a Cambodia firefight. It is a bunch of GIs came across a down flying saucer where the aliens were presumably putting body parts in bags to wrap them up. And so this group of soldiers shot it out with the aliens, and they found, since the aliens had protective covering, that the bullets wouldn't penetrate, so they shot for their heads. And they killed a couple of aliens, and the aliens killed one of our guys. Now, after this happened, then the aliens decided to leave. They took their people and the parts and left. And then our people were debriefed. And, in fact, one of the names for the debriefing group was a name called Magic. And I thought, this is very interesting because it links to some of the classified documents that I've been studying.
And if there were 30 crashes, and we've heard Roswell, Plains of St. Augustine, Magdalena, say Kingman, Arizona, northern New Mexico, south of Laredo, those are places we've heard about in the United States.
Right.
What are the more surprising places?
Well, one case that really impressed me was in 1974, I think, we had found that there was a crash in Mexico. And we'd sent a helicopter over, and we'd seen that there was a Mexican recovery team going after the craft. And so we expected to have a big problem interacting with the Mexican recovery team because, we wanted it. Well, it turned out when we got there, the Mexicans were all dead. They had died of a biological agent. And that, again, is consistent with many of some of the reports that occurred from Roswell, the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report, and also later reported in the first annual report.
Hey, Bob, tell me the kind of enthusiasm you're getting this year for this second annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference.
Oh, I think it's very exciting. I mean, the public is walking in we were not suspecting such a drove of public walking in.
It's great.
Yeah.
And George, if I could pick up on something that Bob was just saying, because I think it is so important to realize that over the years, a piece of evidence or a document or a person in 1 year that didn't have as much context now in 2004 is rich in context. And one of them is in the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit document, which I'm also going to be talking about tomorrow. There is a paragraph and also in the Majestic 12 First Annual Report that the SED security team, four men, began hemorrhaging and died.
Yeah.
Now, I did some research and found that the SED was at Los Alamos,
right,
out of where? The 409th Detachment, that would have been a Roswell-Los Alamos connection. And their assignments, this specific SED team, had to do with anything related to atomic development in the Manhattan Project. And you put all that together, that would have been the logical team that would have been sent to something like a crash disk from another world.
Good piece of research.
Well, this SED work is fascinating to me and reinforces it, draws together everything on the documents that you've been getting, the MJ-12, the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. And George, one of the values of this conference is that we are seeing that all of these different streams of details about the 1947, whatever did happen, at least it appears three objects came down between July 4th and July 6th, 1947, not one. And that at those three landing sites, as the government called them, even though they were crash zones, there were bodies. And those bodies included references in the documents to animal parts, a mixture of something dissected as one would a frog and animal parts would certainly set up a reason for why this government would say, no one is to talk about this. This is to be kept from the public until we understand what it is and can control it. And when I talked with Len Stringfield about that very issue, mm-hmm, I think that he had come to the conclusion that that was one of the big reasons for the policy of denial. What did you talk with him about in terms of that?
Well, I didn't have much time to talk with him personally, but I will say that I did find out just today something that would have excited him a great deal. And, you know, one of the things that everyone assumes that because Len died, that the names of the witnesses died with him. But it turns out if you look at the 86 reports, that 80% of those, the witness who told Len that there was somebody who might want to be interviewed, it turns out 80% of those people are still alive. And I called one of them today just to find out, and he said, he gave me the name of the witness, and this was a witness who was a Marine at an Oregon recovery case. He was part of the guard, and he intercepted a hunter who was trying to get at a crashed UFO that they were taking away. They were loading it on flatbed trucks. So we have the name of the hunter, and we have the name of the Marine, and we can go interview those from now on.
You've been looking at all seven of the status reports that Len did. If you were breaking down about the types of craft, disc, triangle, long tubes, spheres, have you looked at it from the standpoint of how the structure itself might relate to different types and different agendas?
No, I haven't done that, but I'd say for the most part they seem to be discs.
In his work.
In his work. I did, however, do a size calculation. It turns out that there's a fellow by the name of George Early who actually I think is still talking. I think he's publishing an article in Fate magazine. And he was very skeptical of the fact that we could have transported these large vehicles in all these distances because of the roads and that sort of thing. He used to ship windmills, and shipping windmill blades, it turned out he found a lot of problems with getting the windmill blades to the various states. And so in my talk, I'll point out that there are various ways that the government get around this, but one of the things that I noted was that two-thirds of them really were less than 50 feet in diameter, if you look at the statistics from Len's 84 report.
And there was a man who told me that ARCO played a very important role in transportation of these crash retrievals because it was the oil companies that were some of the only companies in the 40s that had anything big enough to get, say, something that was somewhere between 50 to 100 feet in diameter on anything that they could transport.
Well, that's an excellent point.
Maybe that's also another reason why we don't have the UFO propulsion systems yet, because the oil companies
have been hiding it.
Well, George, that's possible.
And that is exactly what Chuck Wade, who's coming up next, thinks. And we are in store for a really interesting discussion of something that I hadn't known about before this conference and talking with Chuck Wade recently, that he and Art Campbell, who was here last year, put together a dig, George, this June of 2004. People are still going to these places and trying to find something. And what we're going to hear next is going to be a discovery. And I have a piece in my hand here tonight, and he's going to show us more and talk about it more. But if we are at a point where in 2004 people can go out to a place where there may have been from local discussion that this is where a craft came down and find unusual material that shows up in a lab as being highly strange, it reinforces that the investigation, even if it's 50, 60 years ago, it's not over, and there's a lot left to be done. And in this upcoming segment, we're going to go back into 47 and a fascinating firsthand testimony from a man whose father knew, Mac Brazel, at the Foster Ranch.
Well, hour number one is done. Three more to go. And by the way, Linda, why don't you tell that band out there in the background outside to take a three-hour break, would you?
You know what, George?
My,
it is like,
my, oh my.
If you were here, I don't remember it last year, it's like we're inside of a beating heart.
I can hear the thumping of the heart. It's pulsating, but
yep.
We can still hear you, so stay with us, Linda. In the Henderson, Nevada studios with Linda Moulton Howe is a man who personally knew Mac Brazel's two sons. His name is Chuck Wade, owner of Wade Building Company in Gallup, New Mexico. Mr. Wade received his bachelor's degree in civil engineering from New Mexico State University. Chuck was born and raised in Corona, New Mexico. In 1947, he was 7 years old, and his father, Jesse Wade, own the only bar in Corona. That's where Mac Brazel first went after finding the strange silver debris. Go ahead, Linda.
And what happened, Chuck?
In 1935, my father was driving through Corona, stopped off at the bar, and before the night was over, he owned that bar. He and my mother, Olla D. Wade, owned and operated the Wade Bar there in Corona for the next 42 years. And it was in the front of this bar in 1947. My dad was standing there when Mr. Mac Brazel drove up in an old pickup truck, quite excited. He came up to my father and wanted Dad to go out to the Foster Ranch and see what in the world had crashed out there. Mac said there's stuff strewn around a lot, and he really wanted Dad to come out and help find out what in the world was out there. And Dad did not have anyone to open the or close up the bar with him, so he refused. And Mac was very, very insistent that Dad come out, and Dad unfortunately did not go. And I've heard Dad mention a number of times over the years that he wished that he had gone.
And there's one place, apparently, that Mac must have stopped, and that was that drugstore in town. What happened?
Yes, in the last 3 years, I've heard on two different occasions from Geraldine DuBois told me that Mac Brazel had come into their drugstore and phoned Roswell to report a crash out on the Foster Ranch.
And then you and your mom, years later, you went to see Loretta Proctor. What did she tell you?
Loretta Proctor and my mother were good friends all of their lives. They went to school together. And Loretta told us, my mother and I, about when Mac Brazel brought some parts and pieces from that crash over to the Proctor home. Mac gave Floyd a piece of what we'll call balsa wood, with quotes. And it was light and wasn't very large. And Floyd took out his pocket knife and tried to cut it. Absolutely would not cut, would not scratch. Then Floyd took out a kitchen match and tried to burn it. Quote, it would not burn. Therefore, it definitely was not balsa.
Now, you knew Mac's two sons.
Yes.
And you became aware through your dad's telling all of this at the bar in Corona. And eventually you became interested enough to go and talk with one of Mac's sons. Can you talk about that very interesting discussion?
In 1980, a book called The Roswell Incident came on the market. I read the book, and in the book itself, there was a picture of Bill Brazel with a caption stating that he had been in the bar there at Corona with some fragments from that crashed disc out on the Foster Ranch, and someone must have turned it into the military, because a day or two later, here came the military and confiscated those pieces.
And what you mean is that Bill, Mac Brazel, the rancher who had gone to Roswell to report this, he's the father. Now this is the son who went back out into that debris field even after our government had been there and tried to gather up everything. And Bill found some unusual pieces. And he talked about those pieces at that same bar in Corona. And it was Air Force, wasn't it, who went and talked to him?
He's had a staff car. So I'm not sure just which branch of service.
Or it could have been some other former government agency, I guess.
But what is it that they said to him?
They wanted to look at the materials. Bill showed it to them, and then they asked him if he would turn it over to them because it was a national security item.
National security.
And he did.
And in that national security context, then that debris that Mac Brazel's son had collected on his own gets taken away. And to this day, no one really knows anymore, or at least if they did, they're not speaking up, because anyone who had debris from that Corona Roswell crash, they had military visit them and things were taken.
That is correct. And whenever I read that caption under the picture of Bill Brazel, I called up Bill over in Capitan because I'd known him all these many years. We discussed a few things, like how my mother was doing, because my father had passed away a couple years prior. And then I read Bill, that quotation we've been talking about, and then I asked Bill point blank, "Bill, is this true?" And he said yes.
That the military had come and taken his debris.
Yes, the whole what it was in that caption was correct.
Now, in a way, you are one of the few people that I've had the opportunity to sit across from who actually was in Corona. You were alive at the time of this notorious 1947, what I think is one of at least three in a three-day period between July 4th and 6th, and we've got documents that say that. And you grew up with all of this swirling around you. What was it that made you switch interests from Roswell to the plains of San Augustine?
1 year ago, here at the crash retrieval conference here in Las Vegas or Henderson, Nevada, Mr. Art Campbell, who lives in the state of Oregon, gave a presentation, and he had artifacts that he had found on the plains of San Augustine. I shook hands with Mr. Campbell that day, but I really didn't get to know him. Then in March of this year, 2004, Mr. Campbell presented at the UFO Symposium, Aztec, New Mexico. He gave a great presentation, and after the presentation, I invited Mr. Campbell to go out for lunch, and we talked and talked and talked about what was down and the potential of what was at the plains, still at the plains of San Augustine.
Art thought that it really needed an archaeological dig, didn't he? That whatever the government had done, they had come in and they may have bulldozed, and that would mean that a lot of stuff was put down underneath the soil.
That would be correct. And he and his wife were the only two people that had been to this crash site knowing that it was a crash site.
And he had found some very interesting things. Can you talk about that one very odd plastic-like object that has the gold in it?
Yes, it's a very, very strange-looking thing. And I'll describe it something like if you take a quart oil, plastic oil container, and melt it down and it just goes out, that's basically what it looks like. But whenever you look at it really close, and then also he's had an MRI made of it, there are many chambers inside of this thing, and also they have found some gold wire, which is extremely thin. There's a picture in the March book that has a human hair, and then this little gold wire is just a tiny fraction of that hair.
Suggesting nanotechnology.
Without a doubt. And there was also some copper wire that was flat and twisted.
Now, you get provoked and interested by Art and his finding some strange things. And what did you find just a few months ago in June out in the plains of St. Augustine?
Martin, Art and I put together a dig, and we met, we got down at the plains of St. Augustine with a crew of men, and I'd made four large A-frames to hold shakers with interchangeable screens. We set up these four shakers, and we started moving dirt.
Meaning like an archaeological dig, and you put the dirt and shake it out and see if something ends up in the screen.
Like you look for gold, huh? Same kind of thing.
Well, this is through a screen system. The gold, I think you'd have a pan to retain it.
But what is it that you found on some of those screens?
Once we started digging, within an hour, we pulled up a piece of metal. And from then on, for the next day and a half, we moved the screens many places, and we kept finding metal.
And George, he's brought into the studio tonight bags of what they found, and it truly is extraordinary.
What do they look like, Linda?
If you could imagine holding something so light in your hand that it is, you feel it, it definitely has a texture and a slight weight, but it's extremely light, and it is so wrinkled, crinkled, and yet relatively flat. Some of the pieces are, would you say, 6 inches across is at least one of them, and one is quite big and a different substance. The thing that's remarkable is that so far, Chuck, You took all of these samples, all six samples that you were able to get from the Plains of St. Augustine in June to New Mexico State Institute, the Mineral Institute, and had analysis done. And what did they find was the composition in all six?
The composition, and we were at New Mexico Tech in Socorro, and the professor there took six of our samples. We have more than that, but I sent him six. And he found that very consistently there was aluminum around 91%, iron 6%, and silicon 3%. And since I found out what was in there, I have been in contact with a number of people that are very, very knowledgeable on foils, and this does not exist in any form that we know of.
And we're talking about the possibility that this was a crash back in the 1947 time period. And you've talked with some people in Alcoa. Was anybody at that time, as far as Alcoa is concerned, using silicon and iron embedded in aluminum?
Absolutely not. They do have three formulas now that is in the Aluminum Association book on the 8000 series. One of them states very plainly the maximum amount of silicon is 0.5%, and the other two formulas don't even come close to what we have.
This is an incredible story, Linda.
Yeah, and George, this new 8000 series has been something that Alcoa has been doing only in the last decade to a decade and a half, not back in 1947, which makes this material. Now, remember, this was not on the surface. They went down. They dug with shovels. They had screens, and that's how they found this material that he is handing me tonight on Coast to Coast. Six fragments in bags that are labeled the same, weighed 1 through 6. If you go to earthfiles.com right now, the top headline at www.earthfiles.com is about this story. And in that Earth Files report, I've got photographs of these some of this unusual material and the breakdown and the analysis. And what I'm going to try to do now is go beyond what he has done and go to the same group that helped me on the bismuth magnesium material. And when you look at this, these photos, I have one at Earth Files that Chuck gave me that shows a very odd distribution. And the distribution seems to be contained, almost as if it was structured this way, in which parts of the material might not have any iron or more silicon, as if there's been a very programmed distribution. Would you say, Chuck, that is an accurate description?
I believe they call that cladding. They take a base piece. In this case, this whole piece of metal is 1/16 of an inch. And I'd like to put that into micron. That's 1,450 microns. And each side of this has a 77-micron cladding to it. And the claddings are iron deficient, but more silicon than the rest of the metal.
I mean, Linda, if you snapped it with your fingers, I mean, would it break? Is it that thin?
No, this one that he's just talking about, the 1,500 microns, is the thickest of all. And is this the one? Okay, yeah, Chuck's going to make a sound with it. Listen to that.
That thing sounds hard.
It sounds metallic, doesn't it?
It is really, really hard.
Yeah,
you're
it does.
And the cladding issue, that is a word we use having to do with a structure in chemistry. But when you look at what they did under the microscope, it reminded me of the same thing we saw in the bismuth magnesium. We're talking about completely different elements. But there was also what appeared to be programmed structure at the molecular or compositional level. That is what this seems
has,
to be.
Has it corroded? I mean, does it look like 57-year-old metal right now?
It's very odd stuff. What he just was clicking, you might even think was ceramic. And the other pieces, if you took something like very fine, maybe paper or foil, tin foil, but it doesn't look like tin foil at all.
But is it shiny or is it old and
dull?
Okay.
It's very dull. And there's one piece that I'm holding in my hand that is about 7 inches by 4 inches, and it's doubled over, so it's twice that size.
What color is it now?
It's a really a dull
Silvery gray?
Yeah, it's a dull silver, yes.
Silver, so it doesn't have this iron look that metal should have by now.
There's absolutely no corrosion on it.
And it's embedded. The iron's embedded and the silicon's embedded in the aluminum. That's what's so strange.
But you can't tell from the inside whether it's on the inside or out. This thing is doubled over like a taco. And on the inside of that taco, there were three little pieces of foil, and all of them looked the same. So it hasn't changed colors. It has been this way from a long, long time.
Well, Chuck, let me ask you, because we only got about a minute and a half left.
Okay.
As a youngster growing up in Corona in that area, I mean, was this a topic that a lot of people talked about for years? Now, you were only 7 at the time, but, I mean, when you were 11, 12, I mean, did they keep talking about this story?
No, the town folks still don't want to talk about it. They want to have their head in the sand. But my dad mentioned it.
Yeah. Was your dad convinced that a flying saucer had crashed out there?
Yes, sir.
Because he knew Mac Brazel really well.
Very well.
And he knew Mac wasn't going to lie.
This is just an incredible story. I mean, witness, you've got to be, what, 64 now, Chuck? Something like that?
65 in 2 weeks.
Well, we need you, so stay healthy, would you? I mean, witnesses.
I understand what you just said.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Linda, would you? How long will it take you, Linda, to follow up on these metal fragments?
Well, it depends now on what the scientist's schedule will be, but I'm hoping that I can do another coast update on this in, say, another 4 or 5 weeks, I hope.
Okay.
And this will be very interesting to see how much further we can take what he has already done in terms of analysis.
Absolutely astounding.
And we don't know what we've got, but this is another crash site that has been discussed. I saw on the list that was shown to me at Kirtland Air Force Base.
Of course, 1947 is the year that has always gotten the most crash disc attention because it's the 1 year that newspaper headlines documented so many sightings from Kenneth Arnold to people literally all over the United States. But after July of 1947, alleged government documents leaked to Bob and Ryan Wood and others indicate that President Truman and his high-ranking officials had decided the highest priority was to preserve national security at all costs, and that the official policy of denial and misinformation was in effect. That meant no one with official knowledge was to talk, and that the public and media would constantly be told false stories to muddy the waters and keep the extraterrestrial presence secret. But the U.S. government did not have control over the extraterrestrial disks, which seemed to continue to crash in a variety of places over the next few years. One place that seems increasingly certain to have been a crash site was the Mesa above Hart Canyon, 12 miles northeast of Aztec, New Mexico. That was the spring of 1948. Up next, Paul Kimball, an expert into this story. And of course, the second annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference taking place right now through the weekend at the Sunset Station Hotel in Las Vegas, parentheses, Henderson, Nevada. Linda Moulton Howe there live with us. Now, Paul Kimball, a Canadian with a law school degree and deep interest in music and filmmaking, took the local Aztec history seriously and produced a recent film entitled Aztec 1948. Paul Kimball, president of Red Star Film and Television Production in Nova Scotia, Canada. He is a member of the Nova Scotia Barristers Society, the Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, and the Nova Scotia Film and Television Producers Association, currently sitting as its board of directors. Now Linda Moulton Howe, along with Paul Kimball. Take it away, Linda.
Thanks, George. When you go to March of 1948, you're going about 9 months after the Corona Roswell, we'll call it the controversy. By then, everybody knew that there had been headlines, disc crashes on ranch in New Mexico.
Yes.
On one day, to be followed very shortly by, no, it's a weather balloon. And all of the controversy in the muddied waters started. Now we come to what the locals think might have been March of 1948. And when you talk to some people in Aztec, they say they remember a headline in Aztec about a crash out in Hart Canyon. But when you it came into the 1970s, 80s, 90s, it was as if this story about a crash of something in Hart Canyon and Aztec had been kind of dismissed as somebody's hoax or mythology. But I know on April 9, 1983, at Kirtland Air Force Base, when I was being shown this alleged briefing paper for the President of the United States, it had a list of crash retrievals in the United States. And it began in 1946, interestingly enough, and went up into the end of the 50s. And on that list, very specifically, I remember it clearly, was Aztec. So I went from the 80s through all of these controversies and these arguments. And so I come to you, dear Paul Kimball, at the 21st century. What was it that convinced you that there was enough about this crash of a disc in Hart Canyon and Aztec that you would go and spend the time and the money to do a film about that history?
The most important thing was the lead researcher, Scott Ramsey, who's been looking into it since the late 1980s. When I go and make a film about UFOs or any subject, any documentary, it's my film. So the condition I attach when I interview people, when I talk to people, is especially in the UFO field, if I come to the conclusion that this is a hoax, in the case of Aztec or Majestic 12, you have to accept that, and I'm allowed to make that conclusion. Not everybody gives you that kind of freedom. What impressed me about Scott was Scott immediately said, all I want you to do is look at the evidence, go talk to people, and come to your own conclusions. That's all I want anyone to do. And he was not saying that he thought that an alien spacecraft crashed in Aztec. What he was saying is the case needs to be reexamined. It spent 50 years almost being shunted aside as a hoax. And he said, it's time to take another look at this, and ufology has done a disservice to the Aztec case.
What was the turning point for you as kind of an outside Canadian who was coming at this as a producer, writer, director of a film, and hitting the information largely for the first time? What was it that hooked you that maybe this is for real?
It really comes down to what the Aztec case has always been labeled as, which is a hoax. And the only, I had accepted that too, what little I knew of the Aztec case, I think what little most people knew of the Aztec case, was this book that was written back in 1950 by Frank Scully, and then within 2 years, oh, it's all a hoax. And the two key witnesses, allegedly, were hoaxsters. Now, there's no question the two guys, Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer, were con artists. Even the proponents of the Aztec case don't disagree with that. But as Stan Friedman says in my film, just because con artists told the Aztec story doesn't mean there wasn't an Aztec story to tell. And when you look at the original articles from that, this is sort of what made me sit up and take notice. When you look at the original article from 1952 in True Magazine, written by J.P. Kahn, a sort of investigative reporter from San Francisco, that is the only basis. Anytime anyone has ever cited the Aztec case and said it's a hoax, they always go back to this article in 1952. And all the article does is say, look, these two guys were con men. Even the proponents of Aztec admit they were con men. There's nothing in there that proves the main assertions that they actually created this entire Aztec story as a hoax. And what Frank Scully said for years afterwards was, no, it wasn't a hoax. No, I wasn't fooled. You say that this Dr. G, the mysterious group of eight scientists, as Scully said, who were the witnesses that told him the Aztec story, Kahn in his article said it's Leo Gebauer, this con man. But he had no proof. Scully denied it, Gebauer denied it, and Kahn couldn't prove it that Gebauer, but everyone's accepted that as gospel ever since. And that's what that's always what interests me.
Without actually looking at the fact that it was Frank Scully in that 1950 copyright book that had a paragraph in it about top secret experimental radar bases protecting Los Alamos and Sandia Base that had Scott Ramsey and Andrew Kistner go off on a search. And what do they find? In fact, top secret classified radar bases that were built from 1946 to 47 and were part of the LASHUP program that our country was using to protect with radar. It was Scully's book. that first talked about it, and I think that everybody needs to go back and revisit Scully, and you are making an excellent point. If a whole body of important work gets dismissed because somebody says, ah, this person was a hoaxer, and they throw the whole thing out, there's too much of that in this field. That's why it is so difficult when there is this body of growing evidence that something did happen. And let's go into some of the eyewitnesses who have been still alive. I've interviewed several of them about the Aztec crash. In your film, what have you personally found was the most convincing testimony of those people still alive about what happened on the ridge? And even if you haven't interviewed the policeman that Scott has just come up with,
that's right,
it's a very important part of the story. So with that, go for the fact that there were people of some credibility there who said there was a death.
Well, before I go into that, there are a couple of other things that I found really interesting. I'm not by nature a conspiracy-minded guy, but Nick Redfern was the first to point out to me when I interviewed him, you know, Leo Gebauer, this con man, his FBI file ran to some 400 pages, and in 2001, 2002, even today, half of that file is still classified for reasons of national security. Now, if all Leo Gebauer was doing out in the New Mexico desert in the late 1940s was running oil scams, I can't understand. It just boggles my mind why the file is still classified.
He was an official plant to muddy the waters. That is what continues to come out in case after mm-hmm. case. Our government's counterintelligence ability is superb, and it was in World War II. It continued into this, the subject that was classified in an executive order by Truman to be off limits from everyone in the public and the media in the interest of national security in order to keep the peace and prevent panic. That means lying became an official order. Gebauer would have been like an official plant to muddy the waters. That's my personal opinion about that case. But that would not take away in any way, shape, or form from the policemen and other witnesses.
Absolutely.
So let's go there.
The interesting, Ken Farley, Doug Nolan, both of whom are deceased now, the first thing they teach you in law school is one witness is great, two witnesses is even better. If you can have an independent witness corroborating what somebody else is saying, and if those two witnesses don't know each other, haven't cooked up the story together, that's powerful evidence. And the question of the two police officers was something that always puzzled Scott Ramsey. He first interviewed Doug Nolan, and Doug said there were two police officers on the Mesa when Doug, a local man from Aztec, first arrived at the crash site. And Scott quite rightly says, you know, you'd have trouble getting two police officers out there today. No offense to the police, but it's in the middle of nowhere. And back in 1948, you know, where did these guys come from? There was the local guy, but who was the other guy? So as Scott says, he put it in his gray basket and said, fine, you know, a lot of the other stuff Doug was telling him seemed to make sense, but that was a little iffy. Then they interviewed Ken Farley a couple of years later, and Ken Farley said he was there. There were two police officers, maybe three. They were both dying at the time. These were men who were gravely ill, but they both agreed on one thing, well, many things, but this to me was critical. These two police officers, this anomaly that had puzzled Scott and many others, independent witnesses saying, we saw two police officers. And they said, we saw each other. They went back to talk to Doug Nolan. He said, we saw the two cops, and then there were two other guys over on the other side of the Mesa. Well, Ken Farley and his friend. So that brings together elements of the story that are not definitive, but they add up to make a very strong case for certainly reconsidering Aztec.
And they had the same description of what was up there on the Mesa. Mm-hmm. Can you go over that?
Well, Scott could go over that a lot better than I could.
Pewter. That was one of the interesting words.
Pewter?
Pewter color. They made a refinement that the policeman said, not exactly silver, a color of pewter. Oh. Now, that's a nice, interesting, subtle difference that when you look back in history, that the color of it was called pewter. And the one of the most interesting things, George, is that when Scott Ramsey, who has been talking with the family members of these two police officers who were passed, but they had finally, in their later years, had finally fessed up to the family that they were there, that they were in Hart Canyon, that they had been up there on the Mesa, they described this disc that was lens-shaped, had a raised, like a little breast on top of it, or cupola, but not big, gentle. And the most interesting thing is, they said that there were two humanoids, or what looked like humans at that site. And of course, the non-grays, something other than the so-called grays with big heads and black eyes, has always been a part of this story. In fact, going back into Europe earlier, first, it was these kinds of human-looking. That raises the level of my curiosity in Aztec even greater, because what is it that came down in Aztec 8 or 9 months after Roswell, and Roswell was clearly either little children, children-sized beings?
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing about Aztec, and as I got more and more into it, I started off on the film, quite frankly, thinking, well, okay, ufology has its hoaxes, and it has its hoaxers, and maybe it's time for a film that exposes one of those as a sort of cautionary tale that we shouldn't believe everything we read or hear. And the more I got dragged into it, I said, well, you know what, maybe this isn't really a hoax. Maybe we've all had it, or most people have had it wrong. And they haven't actually looked at the evidence. And the witnesses that you're talking about, that Scott talks about, Jabauer's FBI file, they've taken core samples out of some interesting, I guess, artifacts, for lack of a better word, a cement block, which is in the film, and bars of rebar. The results aren't in yet, but it'll be interesting to see if those come from the same time period the incident allegedly happened.
And you and I both have been up on that mesa mm-hmm. at different times, and what I find intriguing is that going all the way back into the 70s and 80s, there had been a description by Bill Steinman that there was about a 60 by 150 foot area up there in which the soil, the rocks are literally sheared off, and you can go up there and you can see that to this day. And in this area, there are no trees, or the trees were knocked down, and you can see a difference in growth pattern. It is still there now. We were up there in 2002. Have you done anything in terms of, say, taking any of those sheared rocks or any of those plants or to any university? I've always thought it would be so interesting to see what somebody might say about that if we could get them out there to look at it.
I'm just a humble little filmmaker from a small town in the east coast of Canada. Somebody else gets the rocks. Somebody else does the research. What I try and do is make that research accessible to people when I believe that that research, when they've convinced me that that research might have merit. And you mentioned earlier the radar bases. I meant to say a fascinating way that debunkers work. Because for years, everybody said, no, of course, the radar bases didn't exist, until Scott and Andy went out and found them through a lot of hard work.
Based on Scully's book.
Absolutely.
From 1950.
Which, again, is powerful corroborative evidence. If you could find things in Scully's book that nobody would have known in 1950, but did actually exist, that's important. So they go out and they find the radar bases. What do the debunkers, and I use that term as opposed to skeptics, because I think we should be skeptical.
About everything, that's true.
Absolutely. But people who go out and try and debunk things, they said, well, okay, yes, there were radar bases, but they were, and Carl Flock, who I love Carl. Carl's a great guy. He's been very helpful in my films. But Carl, you know, his quote is saying, well, they were basically World War II retreads, so they didn't matter. And they, you know, they try and distract you from the main argument, which is, did these bases exist? Doesn't matter what kind of radar they had. Were they secret radar bases, and did Scully's book have it right?
And he was not correct about retreads at all. Those three radar installations were state-of-the-art, experimental, and even Stanton Friedman had said, we didn't fully know what we were doing with microwave in radar at that time, at the intensity that they sometimes used it.
It's interesting. If you read the I'm No Expert on 1948 radar systems or 1999 radar systems or any radar systems, but I can read historical reports. And if you read the Air Force reports talking about the base in 1950 and 51, it sounds like Carl might actually have it right, because they were talking about not advanced systems and wanting to replace them with more advanced systems. And, you know, I don't know if Carl has it right. I don't know if Scott has it right. Doesn't matter. All that matters is the radar bases existed, and that it doesn't matter whether they were high-powered, because the whole idea of how high-powered is, could the radar have brought the alien craft down? And that's irrelevant to the central issue.
And there was so much concern that when those were on, it could take down our plane.
Absolutely.
And this was an organizational issue. It was real. It happened. They had, if they turned those things on, they had to clear everything of our planes, or where they would bring our planes down.
Yep.
So that means they knew that if they operated them when something was up there that wasn't us, but they wanted it, they could have used them even in a tactical way.
Yeah, for sure. I've read those reports too. The hilarious thing is, to me, I mean, it's hilarious, usually said by people who've never been to New Mexico. They say, well, it couldn't have been a top secret radar base. I mean, nothing, you know, it's out there. People must have known. Well, I've been there. And even today, it's a top secret abandoned radar base. I mean, you got to drive out into the middle of bloody nowhere to find this thing. If Scott hadn't taken me there, I wouldn't know.
Paul, we only got about a minute left. How do people get to see your film?
They can log on to www.redstarfilm.com and contact me that way. It's got distribution through Tim Crawford down here in the United States. I can get anybody in touch who wants to pick up a copy.
Excellent.
And so, yeah, and George, I hope people will, because I think it's really important to realize that this was happening not just in Roswell. There were things happening in the plains of St. Augustine and Aztec, and we've been talking about land crashes. And after the break, we're going to go on the water and under the water at the southern tip of Nova Scotia in perhaps one of the most documented cases involving both the American and the Canadian government, and 7 days of investigation.
Now wait till you hear this one. Canadian Don Ledger has investigated the extraordinary October 4th through the 11th, 1967 Nova Scotia case of underwater UFOs that provoked both Canadian and American military investigations for 7 days. Don wrote a book published in 2001 about the extraordinary UFO case entitled Doc Object, a term that military authorities used to describe the UFOs in the water. The mysterious events involve several locations: Shag Harbor at the southern end of Nova Scotia, the Canadian Forces base Shelburne, and Burkoro Point, where a NORAD radar base is about 10 miles from Shag Harbor, and the government point, where Americans secretly listened for Soviet Union submarines at the time. Don Ledger learned from two military personnel that one or two objects were tracked coming over Siberia and the Arctic Circle at 7,700 miles an hour before dipping into the Canadian airspace and under the water in Shag Harbor. Now, Don Ledger has worked as a civil servant sound engineer and a television producer-director for the provincial government in the province of Nova Scotia for 34 years. He is a licensed private pilot who has owned two aircraft and has about 1,200 hours of flying time. Don did not begin researching the Shag Harbor incident until the early 1990s, after his friend Chris Stiles told him about the intensive government and military involvement in this 7-day incident. Don had been haunted himself by a personal sighting on October 4th, 1967. Driving by Cape Sable, island south of Shag Harbor, Don was confused and amazed by aerial objects that did not fit any airplane he knew. Linda, this is going to be a fascinating one, my dear. Take it away.
It is. And Don, let's start. Since this was your first hand, you're seeing something in the air, describe it for us. And then talk about the fact that what you're seeing may or may not have been before or after what was being tracked coming over Siberia at 7,700 miles an hour. This is a complicated story with many, many parts. Now, you, your eyes, what did you see?
Well, what I saw that night was approximately 12 or 14 objects, red lights, really, that were maneuvering over an area called Cape Sable Island. This was about 3 o'clock in the morning, just to assuage any confusion here. If this happened at 3 o'clock in the morning after the Shag Harbor incident, that would have been on the 5th, approximately 4 hours later, 3.5 hours later, after the the incident at Sag Harbor. And
but if it had been 3 o'clock in the morning of the day before, you weren't sure whether you were on the 4th or the 5th.
Yeah, it's just going back some time now, approximately, 30-some-odd years. And the only way I could piece it together on my own mind is that this might have been either the night of the Sag Harbor incident or before that, almost 20 hours or so.
Well, you have pilot experience, and you are looking at something in the sky. Can you give us details in terms of color that you could compare it to something we would know? And what exactly are these lights doing with each other?
Well, they're in our, the lights are, like I say, there are red lights. I couldn't see any form or shape. Zipping around, flitting about was the best, probably the best description I could make of them. In the area up over Cape Sable Island, and they were very reckless and haphazard in their maneuvering. I wasn't a pilot back then, but I was always an airplane enthusiast ever since I was a kid. And I knew a lot about aircraft. My father worked in the aircraft industry, and I used to hang around a local aircraft company. And I knew that our aircraft couldn't do anything like this. They would never do anything like this. I was trying to justify it years later when I got involved in the Sag Harbor incident as possibly these being the lights of aircraft that were out searching over the water. But they wouldn't act in this manner. That was just, it's just unsafe. It's foolish to do something in that manner. These things were very anomalous. And but then again, there were just pinpoints of red light, probably the color of a car tail light. And maybe that size at, a few hundred yards. I don't know the exact distance, but from where I was standing, and I've looked at this place a few times, I could guess it probably about a mile and a half to 2 miles away from me.
Pretty close, actually. And I remember you told me when we first talked that you almost had the impression that these red lights were interacting with each other, coming together and then going apart.
Right, yeah. They would, slip through each other, not necessarily one light slipping through another, but if you could call it a formation, a cluster of lights. They were just a ball of lights. It was almost like a ball of fireflies, and they're all flying around through in that little sphere.
And this would have been near the Sag Harbor water, where this other event unfolded so dramatically for 7 days that it seems logical that there is some connection. And now let's go to the first major eyewitnesses who saw something coming down into Sag Harbor, and they thought it was an airplane crashing.
Right. That was a young fisherman. He was just turned 18 years old. His name was Laurie Wickens, and he was coming back from Cape Sable Island, the area I was just talking about, which is to the east, about 13 miles to the east of Sag Harbor. And they're driving along the old highway number 3, which is still there. It's just as weavy an old highway as it was back then. And one of them, he had, I believe, his girlfriend and three other females in the back of the car that he was taking home. And one of them just spotted something in the sky and drew it to his attention. And they watched it as it... It looked like four or five sequentially flashing lights at about a 45-degree angle, angling down towards the water. At least what they would think was the water. There was tree line in the way and so on and so forth. But when they got into Sag Harbor, this thing was getting closer and coming down faster. It had hovered originally for a little bit and then appeared to come down faster.
And hovering is not consistent with an airplane crashing.
No, that's right, yeah. Well, that's another way of ruling it out, you know. They followed, they kept their eyes on it and traveled right through Sag Harbor. He had to speed up, but he had to be careful because he was afraid of maybe the Mounties seeing. This was about 20 after 11 in the evening, maybe getting caught for speeding through Sag Harbor, which would have been a 30-mile-an-hour zone in those days. So anyway, he traveled along for about another 2 miles, and then they just lost sight of it going behind the trees, and they came around the behind the trees and right up on the water, where they were actually, literally 100 feet from the water's edge. Pulled into an old parking lot in what was called the Irish Moss Plant, and got out and watched what appeared to be a pale yellow light on a vacancy of other light, like an absence, like they couldn't see the water at that point, just the light on top of it.
Is that why the government documents later called it a dark object?
Yeah, he reported
absence of light.
Yeah, he reported it to the RCMP as being that case, and they watched it for a while. One of the girls thought she heard a whoosh and sort of a, but they all saw a flash. But one of them thought that she heard a whoosh and a bit of a bang, when this object contacted the water. So when they got out and they looked at this thing, they saw it drifting, they were immediately thinking this was possibly an airplane, and they were concerned.
And he called some authority, and the authority put him on hold, like, don't bother me, right?
Exactly. He got back in the car, and they went about a half mile down to the road to a gas station where there was a payphone. It was quite late in the evening. And he called the RCMP in Barrington Passage, which was the detachment that served that area. They call them detachments in Canada. And he got a hold of Corporal Werbicki, who was was on duty at the time. And Corporal Werbicki, first thing he asked him was, have you been drinking? And Laurie got a little mad about that. And he said, no, I haven't been drinking. And we saw something on the water. We think maybe an airplane crashed. And at that point, Werbicki's phone started to ring. Another line started to ring. So he asked Laurie Wickens for the phone number of the payphone and told him to stay there and he'd get right back to him. So in the meantime, he took the next phone call, and it was a woman calling in from Maggie Guerin's Point, which is right beside the sound where this thing apparently went in. And she said she thought an airplane had just crashed into the water. The phone rang again. A guy from male from Beer Point, which is maybe 3 miles away from that area, reported that he thought he saw an object going into the water, an airplane.
So Sergeant Werbicki now knows that he's got some kind of an issue out there.
Yeah.
Go to what the Coast Guard now, when they finally get out there, and talk about the strange glittering yellow foam.
Okay, that was fishermen. There was when the RCMP finally got to the site after all the confusion was gotten out of the way, and the object appeared to disappear underwater, they went looking for some fishing boats to go out and to see what was going, you know, to see what might have happened, whether there were survivors, was it an airplane crash, what happened there. So they got a couple of fishing boats and they went out the western approach into Shag Harbor and made their way across the water. There's about a mile to a mile and a half between the western entrance to Shag Harbor and an island called Odor Island. So it's sort of bound on either side, the sound. As they were making their way across, suddenly they ran into this long swath of foam on the water, which everybody swears was not sea foam. I mean, they all knew what sea foam was. They live with it all the time. It's all around the shore. And
they said it glittered.
Yeah. Well, this foam appeared to look more to them like shaving cream, more like the consistency of shaving cream, not like soap bubbles. And it was about 3 to 4 inches thick and about 40 feet wide and about a half mile long, or 80 feet wide and about a half a mile long. And it had a glittery appearance to it, almost as if there was flakes of little gold flecks all along the top of it. And they didn't like the fact that they had to sail into it to begin with. And but, you know, they were looking for survivors or possibly bodies. And so they did so. All the time, there was some talk of there being a sulfurous smell in the area as well. And the water itself seemed to be bubbling in areas.
And, Don, because this is a huge 7-day investigation that involved American and Canadian authorities, mm-hmm. let's jump now to the heart of one of the most interesting parts. We've got American up now. We've got Canadians. The Americans had a sensitive submarine listening post there that Americans and Canadians didn't even know about at the time. There's a lot of stuff going on up in Nova Scotia having to do with Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
But now we've got all these people in what in the heck went down in this water. And in come divers or people on the top. Tell about that very dramatic moment and the people that you've talked to about what they said happened.
At Shelburne?
Yeah, underwater.
All right. Make a long story short, these objects apparently traveled from Shag Harbor underwater. They did lose contact. They never found anything on the bottom up there. Apparently traveled up the coast. This was what we began calling the story. The Shag Harbor incident itself is heavily documented. There's no two ways about it. It happened. The forces were there. They were diving, looking for this stuff. But the rest of the story, as they used to say, seems to have occurred up off of another harbor called Shelburne Harbor, off of McNutt's Island. There's an island right at the mouth of the harbor that almost like a stopper. But on the left-hand side of that island, as you're coming out of the harbor, there's a little prominence of land sticking out there, and there's a government installation on there that for years was called Government Point. The real name of the base was CFS Shelburne, Canadian Forces Base.
And our American officials and the Canadian officials knew somehow that this object had moved literally under the water from Shag Harbor up to Government Point, almost suggesting that whatever it was did not want to come out or was using the water for hiding.
Yeah. There's a possibility that one object was damaged. And as this conference indicates, you know, UFO crashes and so on, perhaps one object went into the water disabled and the other object, there was another object present. This is coming from a diver, one of the divers who we originally, Chris Stiles, talked to, who we thought was a diver at Shag Harbor. Turned out that he hadn't dove at Shag Harbor. He was diving at the same time simultaneously up in off of Shelburne. Off a Government Point.
And explain the details, at least, of what they've said that they saw.
The diver explained that what he saw underwater was things working on two of these crafts. One of the crafts seemed to be lending assistance to the other craft, and there were things down there. And when we pressed him for further information, he would never, ever go past things. He just called them things. And at one point he got quite explicit about it, saying, well, you know, I don't care what anybody thinks. These things weren't from this planet. They were, you know, they were from somewhere else, but they don't come from this place. And he was quite angry at the time because we were pressing him in other areas to see if we could jar him loose from the story. And
did you have the impression that he or others had ever been warned really sternly by Canadian or American officials not to talk?
Every one of the five witnesses that we did eventually come up with, which who were military, all of them were military, either wouldn't talk about it or in three cases told us that they were told not to talk about it, warned off, in other words. And so we couldn't take, for sure, I knew that.
And within the last 3 years, you have had some kind of confirmation that there was tracking of object from Siberia right into that area of Shag Harbor traveling at 7,700 miles per hour.
Exactly. That was from an electronic intelligence crew member that was working on one of the sub-hunters that was apparently tracking these things underground. They got their underwater, I'm sorry, and they had information that there had been an incoming object. They actually scrambled aircraft at North Bay, Ontario, which was a NORAD base, and out of Goose Bay, Labrador, which is another NORAD base, Cold War, part of the radar line and defense system.
Which means we may have thought a missile was coming from the Soviet Union.
It was coming right in over from Siberia, from that direction, and they would probably automatically think, oh, this is an ICBM incoming.
And that means our government was on alert.
Yeah.
And whatever the heck went down in Shag Harbor and was there for 7 days with American and Canadian authorities on the water and on the land trying to figure it out, isn't it interesting? They had divers, but there really wasn't any real, what we'd call, aggression. They could have gone down. Did we not go down, Canadian or American, because officials knew we're not dealing with something that's earthbound. We're dealing with something else, and we better stay out.
Maybe no one wanted to go down there, Linda. You know?
Well, one of the divers, there were divers down on it. They photographed it. And that's one of the really startling things about this, is that it was photographed, and the photographs are in the hands of whoever. We don't know. We know who the photographer was. He won't talk about it. And it's just one of those things. It's so frustrating when you run into these things where the military are involved, the authorities, and they just just stand there and smile at you and give you the look and say, we have no opinion, you know.
And, George, that is exactly not just Canada and Nova Scotia, but what happened at Bentwaters in England in December of 1980, which is upcoming with Peter Robbins. In another, one of the most extraordinary cases that involves so many military people, just like Shag Harbor, and so many eyewitnesses at something that was taking place in England over 3 days at least and three nights, and in Canada for 7 days of intense investigation. And yet, George, to this day, all governments deny anything happened.
Another investigator has explored a very large-scale cover-up of UFO events by the United States and England. That's the famous Bentwaters Air Force Base case that involved highly strange aerial light events from December 26 to at least December 28. This was in 1980. Next, an update on this extensive research by Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins has investigated UFO phenomena for 25 years. He is a board member of Bud Hopkins Intruders Foundation and contributes articles to UFO Magazine. Last year, he was event coordinator for the Sci-Fi Channel's New York Alien Abduction Phenomenon Symposium to promote the Steven Spielberg TV miniseries, Taken, and was a consultant and a participant in Sci-Fi's feature documentary, UFO Invasion at Rendlesham. Take it away, Queen Linda Moulton Howe.
Thank you.
And by the way, hi, Peter. How are you?
Good morning, George. Good to hear your voice.
Likewise.
I'm well.
Likewise. Go ahead, Linda.
Well, you know, Bentwaters, that Air Force base in England that has been sort of shared by American and British forces, especially back in 1980, it has perhaps more firsthand British and American military eyewitnesses to high strangeness in that December week of about December 26th through the 28th than any other known case that I know of. But as much interaction as there seemed to be between an advanced craft and even non-human entities that some people described, it was not a crash. It's been described as maybe a landing to repair something. And Peter, I wondered, in all of the research that you have done, does this imply to you right at the beginning that there may have been some communication between whatever it was inside of whatever it was down in Rendlesham and us in RAF Bentwaters?
Well, yes and no. First, it was almost all Americans, because Bentwaters at the time was completely an American RAF base. On the third night, the big one, where the craft appeared in the field called Capel Green near Woodbridge, we have the men ordered to surround the craft. And at a certain point, a ranking officer, we feel that was Gordon Williams, the wing commander at the time, steps through the cordon of men, nobody is armed, and he faces off with these three beings. Now, we know, in human terms, probably 70-80% of all our communication is nonverbal. In that sense, a human being looking at three non-human beings and them looking back at him, certainly there was communication in some sense. But I think it's been spun a bit, and, you know, at its wildest points, we gave them a candy bar and they gave us a pen from Jupiter. You know, I mean, it gets silly.
Well, you are going to one of the cruxes of the story that has at least been anecdotal by several eyewitnesses, including Larry Warren, that you work with, about a high-ranking American authority having some kind of face-to-face with one or more beings. But even before then, what I had heard is that a strange metallic-sounding or mechanical-sounding voice in perfect English with no syntactical accent had come into the base receiving station saying that they were on peaceful terms and they needed something and that they wanted to land. Did you ever get that from anybody on the inside?
Nothing that I've ever been able to confirm. And I know I frustrate people sometimes because I really stand on the points of what we know, what we believe, what we understand, what we fear, and refuse to cross those lines, so I just can't confirm it.
But you've heard that?
Yeah.
Okay, now
but it's rumor mill stuff. I've never heard of anybody that was there.
Let's say we've gone past Christmas night. It's into the early wee hours of December 26th. And all of this light activity that has been reported by John Burroughs and others, it starts. So from your point of view, is the evolution that things were very confusing on the 26th became more confusing on the 27th, and that there were not or was not an interaction with a solid craft and entities until the night of the 28th?
First, the time frame is still a subject of controversy. It may have been the 27th, 28th, 29th, we're not sure. The basic schematic is this. On the first night, lights were observed from the weapons storage areas of the bases, and those are the nuclear weapons storage areas. And as you know, part of the backstory is that we had nuclear ordnance on base in full violation of our treaty with Great Britain at the time.
Exactly. That is something that came out in the Bentwaters investigation that we were violating.
And I should insert right here, because I think people shake their heads when they hear it from an unspecified source, that seems to be going beyond the pale. We know for a fact that beams of light that now we would compare to, say, a laser pointer being shot through a fog, were shot down from these craft into the weapons storage area. We know that they were shot into the area where Halt's group was. Halt told me, himself, sitting across the table from me.
This is Colonel Halt, American Colonel.
Colonel Charles I. Halt, who was he was Lieutenant Colonel at the time, deputy base commander of the base, told me face to face when Larry and I met with him some years ago that these beams of light, we can't explain the physics of it, but they penetrated the bunkers. These are layers of earth, steel, concrete. And his wonderfully chilling phrase was they adversely affected the ordnance. Now,
First-hand testimony from my own brother after Vietnam, being based at Malmstrom, craft set down over the missile kilo silos in Montana. My brother is part of helicopters going. My brother knew firsthand that we took an entire missile out of a kilo, that a big, it was described as being 300 feet in diameter, orange fluorescent glowing, sat right down over the missile silo. And they took the missile out, and my brother knew firsthand that the targeting information had selectively been changed in a missile. And to this day, that is one of the single most classified events. What was that targeting information changed to? What happened in Bentwaters for the beams? What was changed there?
Well, the good news is that they didn't go off. So in adversely affecting them, it was a Cold War adversity that we probably couldn't push a button and aim them at Moscow. But something happened that Halt would not go into any more detail. I think I was amazed that he even told us that much.
Did he ever acknowledge to you about beings, entities?
No. No. I have to say here, I think that there is a certain amount of wedges that have been historically driven between these men. Let's remember the whole thing broke because Larry Warren went forward in 82, worked with Cause as lawyers at the time.
Citizens Against UFO Secrecy.
And that resulted in 83 in the release of that one-page document we now call the Halt document. So there was no love lost there, and there's certainly some animosity. Halt said flat out to us, you know, this wasn't really a good thing for my career.
Could you talk about one of the most, I think, intriguing aspects of the entire Bentwaters episode, and that is what exactly did happen to Bastenza, who was standing next to Larry Warren, who basically disappeared. And Larry told me personally when he came back, after all the controversy about the underground description, which I'm hoping you'll go into, that he did this to protect Bastenza, Larry Warren.
Yeah.
And that Larry was telling Bastenza's firsthand experience because Bastenza broke down sobbing.
Yeah. Adrian is a decent guy, a tough guy. He was a sergeant at the time, a shift supervisor. And I think this may have conflicted to a certain degree with the Catholic theology he was brought up with. It, God knows, it challenged a lot of the men there. I'm sorry to say we've documented several suicides from people who were stressed out. Larry, being the most controversial witness in this, has been caught up in the fact that he was the one with the courage to come forward first and told part of his story, and then told part of Bastenza's story as though it were his. And of course, that has followed him for years of, you didn't tell the truth. Well, nobody else said anything, for goodness sakes.
And if Larry Warren had not spoken up, Bastenza would never, ever, to this day, no one has ever been able to talk with Adrian Bastenza.
Oh, yeah. And you know most recently from reading my conference paper here that Tim Agarik, who was also a D-Flight security cop, spoke to him not that long ago, and he confirmed a number of the particulars, including that the men were ordered to surround this craft and the appearance.
Can you go into this intriguing Bastenza going down into some kind of an installation and maybe even a being on a stage? Can you tell that story?
Well, I will. This was when we came back from our first trip to England in 88. I was very shaken because we had had our own multiple UFO incident, and I had lost the thing I prized most, which was my objectivity. I was now part of the story, and I was not happy about that, although other people might think otherwise, like, what a great break. No, it's not, really. And what happened about 2 months later was Larry had said quite simply, you know, when I said another guy in a case or two, I was talking about me. So in fact, and from what I understand, Adrian was also involved in the same scenario. But on the fourth night, the night after the last incident, Larry and other men were chemically subdued, literally hit in the face, and we know this from the regressive hypnosis that he did with Bud Hopkins years later, with an aerosol, literally thrown into the back of a vehicle, late model black American car, like a sack of potatoes. And the next thing he knows, his nose is running, he's not in real good shape. He is going down in an elevator. And this fascinated me because auditory hallucinations can be very dodgy. He remembered his ears popping. That is not something that can be created in a holographic kind of manner.
That usually happens only if there's a fast rise or lowering in altitude quickly.
Exactly, exactly. And they were going down. Now, he was gone for a day and a half, possibly 2 days, and the pictures that came and went, we all agree, are conditioned to a degree by the way that they were worked on, these guys. We feel, to digress for a moment, that the idea was to put them through kind of a Disneyland on LSD sort of scenario.
To muddy their mind.
Yeah, so that the real memories would fuse with the created memories, and they'd sound like lunatics if they spoke out about it. But we all know people take and hold this to a degree, and other ones don't.
James Peniston was not part of that group, and James Peniston, under a whole other separate hypnosis, remembers not only running with John Burroughs to touch the light or penetrate. He said he could see a silver surface that looked like silver glass with symbols raised, and that it's Peniston going like this, putting his fingers out onto those symbols, and whomp. Whatever it was, he thinks it was instant communication, and that's his famous sentence. They are time travelers, and they're using us and this planet like Band-Aids.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very moved by Peniston's statement there, I must say. There is a guy who sat on this for a long time, suffered with it, and thank goodness has come forward to some degree. I am convinced most of these guys are still holding back to a degree, and who could blame them? We'd probably be in the exact same spot. But in the flashes of memory that Larry consciously remembered, one of them, the one you were referring to, was at a certain point they're taken into a room. It seems like a small screening room, but when they sat down in these big chairs, they could not move. And almost like an Indonesian shadow puppet on the back of a screen was what alleged to be a being. They were hearing voices in their head. He gave himself different people heard different names. Larry heard John. We have testimony from other guys too, and it all sort of dovetails together, but each one is kind of unique.
And one of the haunting things that Larry told me that he remembered getting telepathically, whether it was Bastenza's story or his, was, we allow you to have wars for your entertainment.
And the idea of religion is, you know, we could
right.
discreate it in a moment. I mean, imagine the impact on organized religion if they came out of the woodwork and hung over the big cities.
And the implication was that whatever it was that sat down in Bentwaters over a period of time in things that looked like lights, something that looked like silver glass with
Indeed.
Symbols on it, a whole variety of things, The implication was it had something to do with our planet in ways that involved our past, our present, and our future.
Yeah. Now, this brings up another touchy point, which is when all is said and done, and the hypnosis that Bud did with Larry was extraordinary. I've sat in on dozens of hypnoses over 2 decades now with Bud Hopkins working with folks, and obviously because I had a personal contact on this, it stayed with me more. But what came up in hypnosis had no aliens at all. It was all human beings moving other human beings around. And again, which is the real, which is the manufactured, I think we tend to choose what we can tolerate the most. We all draw the lines in different places for ourselves.
But in 2004, here at this conference, I think it's fair to say that all of us who are speaking, that we have come to understand so much better how well our government can muddy waters by disinformation, by
Absolutely.
Manipulation, by all kinds of things,
they're
whether
artists,
it's pharmaceutical, yes, and that something major happened at Bentwaters, something major happened at Chag Harbor,
yeah.
something major happened at Aztec, Plains of St. Augustine, Roswell, and around the world. Peter, what are you working on now?
I'm beginning research or final phases of research to work on a book about the last days of our first Secretary of Defense. It is a murder mystery hidden in the middle of American 20th century history, a name all of us should know, most of us don't. James Forrestal allegedly committed suicide. He didn't. He was murdered.
Because my understanding from some sources who have never gone on the record is that James Forrestal was one of the, if not the only person in the Truman administration who said and argued, we need to tell the public, we need to tell the world, this is not ours to keep secret.
He was an extremely decent and highly principled man. He was a true patriot in an era, I have to say, when the word is bandied about with a little more freedom than I would like to see.
And he became considered a threat to national security, our own first Secretary of Defense.
Absolutely. And as they say in the Mafia, it's nothing personal, it's just business. The thought, again, this is 1949, nobody knew anybody in therapy. The toughest guy in the government has a nervous breakdown, and then he starts to respond to the treatment. What's going to happen if we release him and he has a relapse or something? He's going to blurt out all this stuff? It can't happen. I'm convinced that many of the core people around Truman who made this decision, and it probably was not a happy decision to make, probably admired him tremendously as an individual. And I'm convinced Forrestal saw the writing on the wall. And then he started to respond to therapy, and the rest is history.
And, George, one of these issues about what was considered of such national security priority that even our first Secretary of Defense may have been taken out, maybe a President of the United States also, because it threatened this, goes to the question, what have presidents been briefed about concerning the UFO phenomenon? And on our next, after this next break, we're going to be talking with Grant Cameron, who has a fascinating story here on presidents and hard evidence.
Linda, it just doesn't get any better, does it?
No, this is wonderful. I think we should put this in a coast time capsule.
And send it deep into space.
Yeah.
And you know what? One day some alien group will get it and go, you know what? They knew more there on that planet than we thought they did.
Some of them were trying very hard.
But they'll say, who was that Linda Moulton Howe person?
I was trying to.
Grant Cameron, director of www.presidentialufo.com in Manitoba, Winnipeg, Canada. Grant has made a serious study of American presidential White House calendars, diaries, documents dated around the times of very significant UFO incidents. Now, for a long time, Grant has urged UFO investigators to seek out well-connected people who run for political office and ask them in public press conferences, have you ever been briefed about UFOs? Always, Linda, a great question to ask.
It sure is. And Grant has been pushing this for some time. And he's here now. We had dinner tonight, in fact, with David Rudiak, who is a physicist by background and is the one who did all of that analysis on this document that is in General Ramey's hand in that famous, notorious 1947 photograph taken inside of the Roswell Army Airfield room, in which there is all this silver debris around the floor, and they're trying to say that Roswell was just a weather balloon. Well, David Rudiak had been able to push some of the computer enhancement on that document, and has become a really powerful resource in wanting to investigate. He is a really good colleague of Grant Cameron, and that we're going now to October 30th, as current as that, and Grant, explain what happened and how David Rudiak came to talk with General Wesley Clark, four-star general, led the forces in Kosovo and ran for president in 2003 on the Democratic platform, a man who, if high-ranking authorities should have any briefings on UFOs, you would think Wesley Clark, four-star general, would.
Okay. Maybe I should set the stage first as to why the briefing question.
Okay, go ahead.
And that is the fact that going back, when you're looking at for UFO truth, you're always looking, who should you talk to, who's going to have the material that you want. And a briefing is an actual, say, the president. The president has to have the top information. At some points, they will come in every day and they'll brief him on a subject, which means the best evidence that they have, they will give to the president. And it basically, the story started in 2001, just after the Bush administration came in. Dick Cheney was on a talk show in Washington, D.C. And Dick Cheney was former Secretary of Defense. He was Chief of Staff. He is now the Vice President. Very, very powerful guy. Always rumored to have been a guy who knew what was going on inside the UFO program. I got on the radio show, and I asked him, the first question up that he took was the question that I asked. And what I said to him was, in all your jobs in government, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? If so, when was it, and what were you told? And basically, I wanted to know, did someone ever walk into his office as Secretary of Defense and say, I'm going to brief you, and the briefing that he gives is the actual information, and trying to get out of him when the briefing was, and then we can pull the document and find out what the actual real information that the government has on UFOs. So Dick Cheney, instead of saying, well, there's nothing to this, I haven't been briefed, basically said, and to quote him, he said, if I had been briefed on that subject, it probably would have been classified and I wouldn't be talking about it. Basically confirmed the fact that this thing's for real. We're not talking about some mythology. So what happened in September of 2003, Wesley Clark was running, and at that point he was running for the Democratic nomination for president, was in New Hampshire in the beginning of the campaign trying to win New Hampshire, and took a question from Jay Buckley, who was an astronaut on the space shuttle, and Buckley asked him, what's your vision of space? Now, the background on Wesley Clark was that he's in the Army, but he wanted to be an astronaut. He couldn't get into the Air Force because he had short-sighted, I believe he was short-sighted, he couldn't get in. So he went into West Point and went up to become the highest rank you can get, the four-star general.
In the Army.
In the Army. So he's asked this question by Jay Buckley, what's your vision of space? And he starts on this long speech about his vision for space, the 100-year vision. And then he says, I still believe in E equals MC squared, but I can't believe that all of human history, we won't be able to go past the speed of light. I believe mankind can do it. So here's a four-star general suddenly talking openly about the fact that we can go past the speed, he believes we can go past the speed of light.
And he's running for president.
And he's running for president, and the National Press Corps is following him around, and at that point it looked like he was one of the favorites. They figured he could win this thing.
And he got clobbered, didn't he, by the media?
He got clobbered. Even in one of the things, they had him as the captain of the Starship Enterprise, and they had him there, and they sort of mocked the whole thing, but nobody followed up with a question.
Right, and they did it just because he brought up going faster than the speed of light without asking the question, sir, on what grounds have you been briefed to say with such confidence that we could go faster than the speed of light?
Which was exactly what I thought. Somebody has to follow up with a question. So I passed, it was actually taped. It was, I believe it was a reporter from Maine taped this. So I got the actual audio clip, and I sent it around to various researchers because he had the National Press Corps, and he was doing open questions in his campaign, and you could easily ask him the question. And I had passed it around, and one of the people inside NIDS told me that somebody inside this group, there's a group of very well-connected people in there, had said that he had been briefed on crash saucer material.
And this is General Clark, and this is coming from an insider in the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, which has now been closed, but was active and had people in it and consulting to it who had actively worked both in military and intelligence capacities.
Correct. So what happened was I went to a number of top researchers, and I knew where he was speaking. I followed his campaign, and basically we couldn't get anybody that would have the guts to stand up in an open forum and ask him the question, were you briefed? Or a similar question, where did you get this idea about going past the speed of light? So basically nothing happened until the Saturday before the campaign. General Clark was campaigning.
On October the 30th. This is only about 3 weeks ago.
Yes. And what happened was he was in Reno, Nevada. He was campaigning for Kerry. They were in this last rush to try to get these swing states. And Nevada was up, so he was in Reno. And David Rudiak had been given the question by me. He hadn't asked it, and this had gone a whole year. He was there and doing research and said, well, he'll sit around and listen to the lecture. And after the lecture, he approached him, and he asked the right question. He asked the briefing question. And he asked the general, he said, in your military career, you talked about going past the speed of light and all this stuff. In your military career, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? And what the general said was, again, he didn't say, hey, there's nothing to this, it's a joke, of course I wasn't briefed.
In fact, tonight at dinner, he said that the general looked sort of down and then kind of looked up as if he was trying to convey in between the lines of what he said, which was,
I heard a bit. In fact, I'm going to Roswell, New Mexico tonight, which Rudiak is quite interesting, because Rudiak is like a Roswell expert. He spends his life, he's got a huge Roswell site up, and he was just fascinated with this statement that he was going to Roswell. We checked the record, and he was actually going to Roswell to campaign for Kerry and Roswell. So he makes this reference to Roswell, and Rudiak was smart enough not to fall for this and get sidetracked. He went back to the question. He said, so you were briefed, getting this whole thing of, did you get clear information from the government as to what's going on? And the general said, there are things going on, but we need to work out our own mathematics.
And mathematics has come up in other contexts in research that you've done, having to do with what have presidents known, what have the people around presidents known related to extraterrestrial biological entities, and isn't one of those famous links to mathematics Eric Walker?
Eric Walker was a guy who had worked in the Eisenhower administration. He'd done a study for the president. And at one point, we had questioned him. There's about six researchers around the world. We knew he was involved. We knew he was involved from the word go. He was the former president of Penn State University, had a PhD, 15 honorary PhDs. He was very well known, very connected. And we would ask him different questions, and people would try to interview him. And at one point in one of the interviews, he was being interviewed by a guy from England. He cut him off and he said, let me ask you a question. How good is your mathematics? And the guy who was interviewing was a physicist. He said, well, my math is as good as any physicist. And he said, I can tell you, unless you have the mind of Einstein, you're never going to figure this thing out.
And today, in 2004, you're trying to get to the hard evidence of what is around presidents in terms of briefings. And if we have these hints that Wesley Clark, Eric Walker, even in Danny Sheehan's cases as a famous civil rights lawyer who gets involved with blocking space, using space and weaponry, and becomes convinced that there's an extraterrestrial presence. How do you interpret now that the mathematics would play into our relationship with whatever it is that Wesley Clark is saying something's going on?
Well, my interpretation of the mathematics is that the military, the government, is always looking at the whole technology aspect of it.
Can we go faster than light?
Yes, and the whole thing about it's for real, it's there, we've got the crash saucer material, but how do we go to the point that we can use it ourselves?
And they don't want anybody else on the planet to have that technology except the United States of America.
Yes, and it would appear, I mean, you can sort of extrapolate that they're spending a lot of time working on the thing, and even hell put off people like this will talk about mathematics. It's always seems to be the key is that there's something there that we have to work out.
And other insiders have told me and told others over the last 20 years that they've seen demonstrations of light stopped. Then it was stopped in the context of time travel. Do you think we actually are applying some kind of extraterrestrial technology that can do that?
I think they're trying to work back. I guess they're missing this piece. They're trying to get this piece, and it's connected with the mathematics that our knowledge is not to the point where we can actually figure out the whole mechanics of how it works.
And the implication there is then that the non-human intelligence is not going to help us.
Exactly, and that would appear to be, if you take a look at the aliens. I've always said the aliens, if they wanted the cover-up to end, could end it tomorrow. They are part of the cover-up. They are in favor of the cover-up. Otherwise, they would end the cover-up.
To what end? And this is where it gets really spooky and eerie when you have to figure in animal mutilations, the human abduction syndrome, the possibility that we have tried to bring down their craft and they may have retaliated, that the underbelly of this story may be so complicated, and that our government now is worried not only about exposing this to the public, which would mean to the world, but covering up perhaps their own abuses?
Exactly. I would agree with that, yeah.
And right now, if you said what you're going to present tomorrow, what is the hardest evidence about a president being briefed on extraterrestrial biological entities and their technologies?
Well, the briefing thing is a little difficult. I mean, you have a number of references, for example, to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was always, if you see in the UFO community, was always referenced that he made the promise, he went in and he didn't do anything. If you look behind the scenes, Jimmy Carter actually did get a long way along the road. And he did, for example, the vast majority of the UFO documents we have today were released during the Carter administration under the Freedom of Information Act. And I know from inside the CIA, from source inside the CIA, that the CIA was under tremendous pressure to release documents. They didn't want to. They were under tremendous pressure from Carter to release. The Carter, there's a number of stories about Jimmy Carter getting a briefing and that he forced the briefing. They didn't want to give it to him, and that he got possibly two briefings on the subject. Shirley MacLaine talks about this. She was confronted on the Larry King show, and another fellow by the name of McGeorge, who was a Secret Service agent. There's a story that I'm going to Roswell on Monday to track Liebelson, who was the UFO editor.
Harry
Liebelson. He was the editor of Omni magazine. Tells a story that he says was told to him by McGeorge of the fact that he was in the President Carter briefing. And he basically describes what happened in the briefing. And I think it was very similar to the briefing document that you were shown,
yes.
The presidential briefing document at Kirkland Air Force Base, basically going through the history of the aliens, going through the implications.
Their genetic manipulation of all kinds of things,
yes.
On this planet.
And apparently this shook up Carter. Now, the one interesting thing that I found that seems to confirm that a lot of these briefings took place was the fact that I have a friend who offered to help me out and contacted two presidents, President Ford and President Bush. They both confirmed that they had been briefed on UFOs. Both of them wouldn't identify when the date was, wouldn't go into any details, just confirmed. But they both confirmed that part of the presidential briefing involves a thing called the Holloman Air Force Base film. And this is a film that's very famous. I'm going to talk about it on Sunday at as great length as I can about what happened. It's a film that you were offered. It's a film that purports to show Holloman Air Force Base. Now, it depends which date. They give out different dates to keep it confused. 1964 is one date. 1972 is the other date. And it was a film that supposedly three alien ships were. This was all based on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Close Encounters of the Third Kind
was based on that.
It's based on this on the
That's right.
on the thing. And it comes down to whether Steven Spielberg was fed this information. But it's a story of three ships. The one comes down. The two leave. The three aliens get out, they meet high-ranking officials, they walk down the tarmac, and this is filmed from five different angles.
That's right. And the date I was given was April 25th, 1964, and it was described to me by a man who had said he had watched all of the film many times, because I was supposed to work with a NASA technician on this. And that the two craft, this is something that what they say the Ebens, the Ebens is a particular type that the government classifies, always will keep two disks above and one below in a triangular configuration in a defensive mode. And that they did that day, but that there was an exchange of not only technology, but of bodies. And I was told that we gave back to them some bodies that we were preserving.
Exactly. So this is a critically important thing. This is the contact between the aliens and the U.S. government. And these two presidents had confirmed that this was part of the briefing that they had been given. Now, the interesting story about the McGeorge story was that a lot of people didn't believe it, but they didn't have the information that I had, that the other presidents had seen the Holloman Air Force Base film. If you see Harry Liebelson's story, when he tells it, part of the story that he tells about being in this briefing that he was involved in was the fact that Jimmy Carter was shown a 15-minute color film, the Holloman Air Force Base story. And it basically seems to confirm that the McGeorge story, although a lot of people say they don't really believe it, seems to confirm that this may actually have been true if this Holloman Air Force Base was brought up.
And this film, George, that Grant is talking about, yeah, is in the 1973 or 4 dated film called UFOs, Past, Present, and Future, produced by Alan Sandler and Robert Emenegger. And at the end of the film, when they hypothesize that there may have been or could be in the future a landing, perhaps on a military base such as Holloman Air Force Base, and they show a clip, and it lasts, Grant has timed what he has at 6 seconds.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I've seen it several times myself, and you see a white object that is going by hills that is at Holloman.
Right.
And that white object is one of the three, and that the all of the film exceeded 600 feet that day.
And I will show the actual clip on Sunday.
So. Okay. We are beginning to put a bigger picture together. It all seems to link.
All right. Well, Grant, thank you so much. Fascinating material. Linda, you stick around because we're going to open up the phone lines now. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Linda Moulton-Howe is out there at the annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Henderson, Nevada. Enjoying yourself out there, Linda?
I am. And I thought tonight was one of the, I would say, getting closer to showing the public that these pieces are beginning to fit together in patterns that give us insight that both from the government's point of view and from the hard physical point of view. And don't you feel, George, that it's there? It just needs that official authorization from the government.
Very consistent. You can see it. You can see the little tentacles all beginning to connect.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good.
Enjoying your show. And first time I've gotten through, I'm here in Cartersville, Georgia, just north of Atlanta.
Welcome. Glad you got in.
And I had a really strange thought about 1964. The 1964, when the British invasion with the Beatles happened. And it seems like a whole generation was dumbed down by their love in the summer of love in 67 and right up into the middle of 70s when by the time Spielberg had Close Encounters come out in 77, that, you know, it took all that information of what you're talking about was being presented to the government, and they had to like shut the youth to say to that generation who was really receiving the message. You know what I'm saying? In a sort of, common, consciousness, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And instead of focusing that consciousness to the our visitors and what they were trying to probably as a peace offering or some kind of greeting, they dumbed it down to a love-in, you know. And we of course know some of the fallouts of that. That's kind of gone down the generation that you know, the lost generations that we call the 70s. Do you understand what I'm trying to say here?
I think you're talking about the government's effort to deflect attention on what was happening in relationship to a non-human presence on the Earth, and that what happened to essentially my generation may have been a deflection. But let me add a personal note. I had my back beaten with a billy club out in front of the Military Induction Center in Berkeley in 1967, October. That's when Joan Baez was dragged away, and I think she was jailed. And when you look back at, I was at Stanford University, and we were up there. I was actually reporting for the Stanford Chaparral magazine, and nobody was there with weapons, and none of us had any aggression, but the anti-war movement seemed to me to be at the base, meaning anti-Vietnam War, at the base of the generation that I was in, resisting what the government was doing. Now, what you're raising is fascinating, that there could have been another reason why suddenly the generation that I was in college was against the Vietnam War, and we had our backs beaten and a lot of other things. But it may have been an opportunity for a government to use something that had a completely different source to deflect attention. So one way or the other, there may have been a conscious manipulation and use of an event in society to deflect attention from what was happening with the non-human.
You know, Linda, if this planet has been visited since its inception, and I believe that. I mean, I believe that we have been visited by extraterrestrials from different planetary systems back thousands and thousands, perhaps millions of years ago. Why are governments covering it up now? I mean, do you think governments of the 1,200-year-old governments, the 1,200 AD, 600 AD, they did the same thing to their own people?
It's right at the heart of what I'm presenting tomorrow after lunch at this conference. I'm talking about what would be the reasons behind a policy of denial in the interest of national security, and I have become convinced that the men that are referred to as Majestic 12 that were with Truman in the 40s came to the conclusion that when the security team that went to one of three crash sites between July 4th and July 6th, 1947, and ended up within 24 to 48 hours collapsing, hemorrhaging, and dying, when they found animal parts, allegedly, in one of the craft at White Sands, when animal mutilations and human abductions were clearly a part of a story of which the government had no control and did not understand. I'm not painting a picture of my own comprehension of what the agenda is, and I'm not trying to say that there has been any whole-scale invasion to do anything to the general human population. But if you're sitting at the end of World War II in the Truman administration's shoes, and you've got something that is in the skies and is able to do 90-degree turns, and you know that you've got advanced technology, and you don't know where it's come from, and it comes down, or you shoot it down, which is another part of my presentation, I am convinced, just as Len Stringfield said, we tried aggressively to bring these disks down. We wanted technology. We wanted to know what was in them. I think, George, there was retaliation.
If you had a stick and some guy was holding a rifle against you, and you knew what that rifle was, would you go up there and try to swing a stick at him?
That's why I think we stopped trying to swing at it, and I think we changed our tactics, and I think that the phenomenon also changed its reaction to us, and that the policy of denial in the interest of national security to preserve the peace and avoid panic has to do with the fact that they knew that there were animal parts. They knew that there was retaliation. They knew that they were dealing with something that they could not control, but they wanted the technology. They wanted to understand it. And I think eventually, just exactly as we were talking about the Holloman incident, that there were face-to-face communications with at least one of these intelligences. The thing that's amazing, George, is that we are almost now to 2005. And there still is not a crack, a crease of any kind of official government release. I'm saying, you know, with authority, that something from somewhere else in the universe has been here, not only been here in this century and last century, but one of the briefing documents that I was shown at Kirtland Air Force Base and was linked to President Carter, it even had a sentence in there that said that these extraterrestrial biological entities had been coming to this planet since before the time of the dinosaurs. And I remember my mind jolted because dinosaurs are supposed to be 270 million years old. And that would mean if this is in an alleged formal government document that was shown to a president, whether it was President Jimmy Carter or somebody else, it means that somebody in the government became convinced from something it was shown that there would have been this presence here 270 million years ago.
Well, maybe that's where when Michael Cremo gets his forbidden archaeology stories of footprints next to dinosaur prints, maybe it was an alien running around, you know?
George, really, that is. Cremo's stuff is so important because there are all of these strange aberrations going back and that are preserved in stone. And if it's linked to genetic manipulation throughout the planet, in the plant life, the primate life, and the animal life, what have all of these genetic creations been made for? What is going on currently? And if you're a government and you don't understand it, you can begin to see why no one wants to stand up in front of a bank of microphones and say, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here today to explain to you, and then try to tell this story, and that perpetuates the silence.
First time caller line, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
How are you, George?
Welcome.
I was stationed at RAF Bentwaters from 77 to 79. That's basically what I'm calling about. I don't know if your guests are aware, but there were nuclear weapons at that base.
Oh, yes.
And it is a twin base concept. Are you also aware that there was a twin sister base referred to as Woodbridge?
Yes.
And according to Robert Stack's show, Unsolved Mysteries, that's where this occurred. However, I would like to challenge everything that you said tonight. It's filled with holes.
First of all, Bentwaters, the event we are talking about took place in the Rendlesham Forest, and it was December 26th to the 28th of 1980.
That's correct. I know that. But what I'm saying is, because of the Cold War situation, and the mission of the base was to protect England and the invasion of the Russians to the English Channel, etc., the nukes had to be stationed there. Any attempt to fly over that base by civilian aircraft was met immediately with, in some cases, scrambling aircraft, a lockdown on the base, and other things. Also, just from a human standpoint, had that occurred, what you claim occurred, every housewife, child, and airman on that base would have known about it the next day. It's a small community of people, and there's no way that any aircraft could have flown over that without the 11 to 7 shift that worked that night. They're on the radio constantly. I personally worked on the flight line in a section called Material Control, which we were responsible for mission-capable procurement of parts. We were on the radio all night. There were lights all over the place. The organizational maintenance, the radar people, there's no way that any aircraft could have flown over that vicinity without the squadron commander, not the base commander, there's two different people now. The base commander was in charge of admin. The squadron commander was in charge of the mission. He would have known about it. It would have been documented. It would have gone back to the 3rd Air Force all the way up to the highest command. It would have been well known and documented.
Yes, we have documents.
I don't understand why. And another thing,
we have documents from colonels.
a lieutenant colonel is not a 4-star general, okay? And there were men on that base that had several problems psychologically. Several men were alcoholics. They were being mustered out of the Air Force.
You there in December of 1980?
No, I wasn't, but I was there. I left there in July of 79, and I know what the mission was about. All right?
Tell you what, sir, I don't have the time to take your dissertation because I've got 900 more calls and 6 more minutes, but I tell you what, the next time we do a full program on this, call in and I'll give you your due, okay? Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
I'm a truck driver, so here's my horn.
There you are.
My daughter, get this mathematics thing, my daughter used to go around saying, for as long as me and my wife can remember, I don't know where she came up with it, it's called EN24. And I have no clue where she ever came up with these numbers at.
You're thinking of EM. Linda, can you help him?
Well, immediately what went into my head was a variation on MC squared or something like that. You're thinking of a formula?
Yes.
Well, you know, lots of people come up with a lot of things. It's hard to know. Right now, unless you had any other information that she was giving about it, it would just be one of those eccentric things that's come into somebody's mind.
Maybe she's the reincarnated version of Albert Einstein.
Well, it's slightly different than E equals MC squared, but...
Well, maybe Albert's a little mixed up wherever he is now. No, I don't know. I wish I could help you, actually, and to be serious, but you never know. I've heard stories of little kids who have never played the piano before, Linda, sitting down playing Mozart, for crying out loud.
Right.
Next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, first I'd like to say, George, that you do Art Bell a great justice in his on the show there, and this is kind of a fascinating yet a frustrating type of a show we got tonight, because you hear all these facts and... I've never actually experienced a UFO myself, and I'm not a skeptic. I consider myself an open-minded person, and I would have to agree that this planet has been visited by some aliens at some time or another, and that if you didn't believe that, that you know, you're probably one of these people that would have thought the world was flat back when Christopher Columbus was around, but... My thing was, is when I was in the Navy, I'm a U.S. Navy veteran.
All right, I knew I liked you.
And I was stationed in Guam, and as far as distrusting the government, I've got a left leg full of that, but we used to take the spent fuel cores off the 688 submarines and drop them in the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest water in the world. And it's funny how the government does things and puts on another face about it, and then, you know, acts like nothing's ever happening. And so my question is, you know, what can we do to have these facts revealed? I mean, is there something we can do as regular citizens of the country and some sort of thing that we can do to have these?
Well, a question that keeps coming up, Linda. What can people do?
Well, I wish I could say that getting in touch with your congressman would help, but over the years, the few congressmen who have tried, like even Gerald Ford, in some of the hearings, it gets knocked down in very strange backdoor sort of ways, which I think comes right back to what I was talking about, that there is, and at least I've been told, I can't prove, that there's a classified executive order that President Truman signed that would make it then a law of people who were in a specific classification, a magic classification with a certain need to know, that they could not, under any circumstances, describe anything in their work, their knowledge, related to the presence of extraterrestrial biological entities on this planet. And if that is a formal order, in the context almost of war, and it keeps being passed from administration to administration, it means that today, in 2004, that same policy would still be in effect, saying that everybody would have to lie, misinformation, denial, putting people out, hiring people, making their job be to muddy the waters would be consistent with that executive order. And I personally think that that is probably close to the truth. And so then the question is, how do we get past a classified executive order and change it?
Well, who knows? Linda, we're running out of time. We've got a minute left. Want to give us your website?
Oh, thanks. It's www.earthfiles.com. That's a reporter reporting files about the Earth. And it's about science, it's about environment, and it's about real X-Files. And I hope that everybody listening will go and check out the story on Chuck Pace's Strange Material from the Plains of San Augustine, a wonderful story that I did with Grant Cameron about David Rudiak's discussion with General Wesley Clark, and a whole lot more. And it's been a pleasure, George, to be with you again on Crash Retrieval Conference.
Indeed. It's been a great time, Linda. You take care of yourself. Have a great time in Henderson, Las Vegas, okay?
Yes.
All right, you take care.